Chapter 10. In her dream, Skye was having dinner with Austin in a Parisian bistro near the Eiffel Tower, and he was saying, "Wake up." And she was answering, with no little irritation, "I'm not asleep." "Wake up, Skye." Austin again. Irritating man. Then Austin was reaching across the table, past the wine and pâté, gently slapping her cheek, and she was getting angrier. She opened her mouth. "Stop!" "That's better," Austin said. Her eyelids popped open like a pair of broken window shades, and she turned her face away from the blinding light. The light shifted, and she saw Austin's face. He looked worried. He gently squeezed her cheeks until she opened her mouth, then she felt the hard plastic mouthpiece of a scuba regulator between her teeth. Air flowed into her lungs, reviving her, and she saw that Austin was kneeling by her side. He was wearing an orange dry suit and some strange sort of headgear. He took her hand and gently wrapped her fingers around the small air tank that fed the regulator. "Can you stay awake for a minute?" he said. She nodded. "Don't go away. I'll be right back." Then he stood and walked toward the staircase. In the brief instant before he descended into the water with his electric torch, she saw the others who'd been trapped with her, all looking like derelicts sleeping off a cheap wine binge in an alley. Moments later, the water in the stairway emitted an eerie glow, and Austin reappeared, holding a line slung over one shoulder. He dug his feet in and hauled on the line like a Volga boatman. The floor was treacherous underfoot, and he slipped to his knee, but he was up immediately. A plastic bag that was attached to the line came out of the water and slid across the floor like a big fish. More bags followed. Austin quickly unzipped the bags and handed out the air tanks that it contained. He had to shake a few people into a groggy consciousness, but when they got their first breath of air, they revived quickly. As they greedily sucked down the life-giving air, the metallic sound of the regulator valves was loud in the confined space. Skye was finally able to speak. "What are you doing here?" she said, like a society doyen addressing a party crasher. He hoisted Skye gently to her feet and kissed her on the forehead. Never let it be said that Kurt Austin let a little hell or high water stand in the way of our dinner date.
"Dinner? But..."
Austin tucked the regulator back between Skye's lips. No time for talking. Then he was opening the other bags and pulling out dry suits. Rollins and Thurston were both certified divers, as it turned out, and they helped the others get into their suits and scuba gear. Before long, the survivors were suited up. Not exactly a SEAL team, Austin thought, but with a lot of luck, they might make it. "Ready to go home?" he asked. The muted chorus that echoed in the cave was incomprehensible but enthusiastic. "Okay," he said. "Here's my plan." A few minutes later, Austin was leading the pitiful-looking cave dwellers down the staircase and into the flooded tunnel. More than one eyebrow was raised at the strange vision of Zavala waving at them from inside his glowing bubble. Austin had foreseen that his passengers would need something to hold on to during their ride. Before he and the Mummichug's crew had piled the dive gear bags onto the sub, they had stretched fishing net over the Seamobile's deck. With vigorous use of hand signals, pushes, and prods, Austin arranged the cave survivors face down on the deck in rows of three, like sardines in a can. He put Renault, with his bad hand, in the first row, right behind the bubble, between the reporters. Skye was in the middle row between Rawlins and Thurston, who were the most experienced in the water. He would be behind her in the third row between LeBlanc, who seemed strong as a bull, and Rossi, the young research assistant. As insurance, Austin ran lines over the backs of his passengers as if he were securing any bulky cargo. The submersible was practically invisible under the tightly packed bodies, but the arrangement was the best he could think of with the limited space available. Austin swam to the rear where he put himself behind Skye. He would have to move freely from his perch later, so he left himself unfettered. "All our ducks are lined up in a row," he said over the communicator. "Tight quarters back here, so I'd advise against picking up hitchhikers." With a whir of electric motors, the Seamobile inched forward at a crawl, then sped up to a walk. Austin knew the survivors must be weary beyond words. Although he had cautioned the group to be patient, the vehicle's slow pace was maddening, and he was having trouble abiding by his own advice. At least he could talk to Zavala. The others were alone with their thoughts. The submersible plowed through the tunnel as if it were being pulled by a team of turtles. At times, the submersible seemed to be standing still, and the tunnel walls were moving past them. The only sounds were the monotonous hum of the motor and the burble of escaping air bubbles. He almost yelled for joy when Zavala announced, "Kurt, I can see the columns dead ahead." Austin reached up and playfully grabbed Skye's ankle. She wiggled her foot in response, but it was the only light moment in the otherwise harrowing journey. Austin lifted his head. "Stop before you get to them. I'll bird dog you through the slalom course." The Seamobile coasted to a halt. Austin detached himself from the deck and rose above the bubble. The first set of supports gleamed about 30 feet ahead. With easy, rhythmic kicks of his fins, Austin swam toward the supports and passed through the gap he had cut in the columns. Then he spun around and waved Zavala through like a traffic cop, directing him to the right or left as needed. The submersible eased slowly through the opening. Zavala veered from his straight course to steer through the next opening, and that's when he got into trouble. The overburdened submersible responded sluggishly and skidded into a slide. Using a steady hand on the thruster controls, he arrested the sideways momentum and headed the submersible toward the opening. But as the vehicle passed through the breach, he tried to compensate and the sub clipped a column and began to fishtail. Austin swam off to one side and plastered himself against a tunnel wall until Zavala prudently brought the Seamobile to a stop. Austin swam up to the cabin. "You really have to do something about your driving, old pal." "Sorry," Zavala said. "With all the weight in the back, this thing handles like a bumper boat." "Try to remember that you're not behind the wheel of your Corvette." Zavala smiled. "I wish I were." Austin inspected the passengers, saw that they were holding up, and swam ahead to the next set of columns. He held his breath as the vehicle and its load eased through without incident. Zavala was getting the hang of controlling the sub, and they successfully navigated several more sets of columns. Austin kept a count in his head. Only three more sets of pillars to go. As he approached the next set of columns, he noticed something was off kilter. He squinted through his mask and was not reassured by what he saw. He had cut the middle column out, and now the supports on either side of the opening looked like a pair of bowed legs. A quick movement caught his eye, and he glanced upward. Bubbles were streaming through a narrow fissure in the ceiling. Austin didn't have to be a structural engineer to figure out what was happening. The ceiling weight was too much for the remaining supports to bear. They could collapse any second, entombing the submersible and its passengers in the tunnel forever. "Joe, we've got a problem ahead," Austin said, doing his best to keep his voice calm. "I see what you mean," Zavala replied, leaning forward to peer through the bubble. "Those columns look like a cowboy's legs. Any advice on how we navigate this mousetrap?" "The same way porcupines make love. Carefully. Make sure you walk in my footprints." Austin swam toward the bowed supports and easily passed through with space on either side. He turned and shielded his eyes against the sub's bright halogen lights, then waved Zavala ahead. Zavala successfully maneuvered the vehicle through the opening without touching either column. But he ran into trouble from an unexpected quarter. Part of the net trailing off the rear end of the submersible snagged on the stub of the column Austin had cut. Zavala felt the tug and instinctively applied power without thinking. It was the worst possible thing he could have done. The vehicle hesitated as the thrusters dug in, then the net tore free and the sub lurched ahead out of control, smashing into the right-hand column of the next set with all of its substantial weight. Zavala quickly compensated for the wild swing, but it was too late. The damaged column buckled. Austin watched the slow-motion disaster unfold. His eyes darted to the ceiling, suddenly obscured by a massive cloud of bubbles. "Move out!" Austin shouted. "The roof's coming down!" Curses in Spanish filled Austin's earphones. Zavala applied full power to the thrusters and aimed for the next gap. The vehicle passed within feet of Austin. With perfect timing, he reached out and grabbed onto the fishnet, dangling like a Hollywood stuntman on a driverless stagecoach. Zavala was more intent on haste than precision and didn't bother to fine-tune his steering. The vehicle clipped a column. It was only a tiny dent, but the column bent and snapped. Austin had managed to scramble back onto the deck by then, and he held on grimly as the vehicle spun completely around and regained its proper heading. One more opening loomed ahead. The submersible made a clean pass through the space without touching a column, but the damage had already been done. The ceiling burst asunder and crashed down in a crushing avalanche of huge boulders, releasing the water stored in the glacial pocket. Thousands of gallons of water poured into the confined space of the tunnel. A powerful pressure wave hit the Seamobile and pushed it through the tunnel like a leaf through a sluice. The wave rushed toward the entrance, carrying the vehicle on its crest. Unaware of the drama unfolding in the dark recesses below the glacier, the support crew had drifted back to the helicopters. The lone crewman who'd been keeping watch for the vehicle had stepped outside the tunnel for air when he heard the roar issue from the bowels of the earth. His legs reacted before his brain did and carried him away from the tunnel mouth. He was off to one side, hiding behind a boulder, when the vehicle shot out of the tunnel's entrance into the open air. The wave's full force expended itself outside the cave, leaving the vehicle high and dry. Dazed and battered passengers untied the lines that held them and dropped off the deck. They spit out the regulators and sucked fresh air into their lungs in great coughing gulps. Zavala was out of the cabin, running back toward the tunnel. He stepped aside when a secondary, weaker wave burst from the tunnel, surged around the vehicle, and disgorged a struggling figure in an orange suit. Austin's cracked face mask was askew. The communicator helmet had been ripped from his head, and the force of the wave was rolling him like a ball caught in the surf. Zavala reached down, caught Austin in mid-roll, and helped him to his feet. He was as unsteady as a drunk, and his eyes were as glassy as marbles. Austin spit out a mouthful of foul water and barked like a wet dog. "Like I said, Joe, you really have to do something about your driving." The French rescue team arrived an hour later. The helicopter dropped down in front of the power plant like an osprey on a fish. Even before its runners had touched the ground, six dashing and rugged mountain climbers piled out the door, lugging carabiners and coils of rope. Their leader explained that they brought mountain climbing equipment because they understood people were trapped on the glacier, not under it. When the leader learned that his team's services were not needed, he shrugged and admitted philosophically that even a crack mountain team would have been useless in a water rescue. Then he broke out a couple of bottles of champagne he had brought along. Raising his glass high in a toast, he said there would be other opportunities. People were always getting into trouble in the mountains. After the impromptu celebration, Austin supervised the submersible's return to the Mummachug, and then he returned to the power plant with Zavala. The survivors had been shuttled to the plant for showers and hot food. Dressed in a motley assortment of borrowed clothes, they had gathered in the plant's recreation room to tell their story. The reporters ran the videotapes of the attack on Renault, but they were of poor quality and showed only a blurred glimpse of the gunman's face. The audio tape revealed little except for the brief exchange between Renault and his assailant. Austin was nursing his bumps and bruises with a bottle of Belgian beer from the power plant's larder. He sat with his chin cradled in his hand, feeling his anger grow as Sky and the others trapped in the tunnel described details of the cold-blooded act that almost condemned several innocent people to a horrible death under the ice. "This is a matter for the police," said Rouet, the power plant supervisor, after he had heard the full story. "The authorities should be notified immediately." Austin held his tongue. By the time the gendarmes arrived, the trail would be colder than the beer in his hand. Renault was anxious to leave. Brandishing his hand as if it were a fatal wound, he bullied his way and found a seat on the power plant helicopter. Rawlins and the reporters were eager to file details of their story, which had gone far beyond the discovery of the frozen body. The reporters called in the chartered float plane that had delivered them to the glacier. The plane's pilot cleared up one mystery. He said he'd been waiting on the lake for the reporters to return from the glacier when a big man he had brought in showed up at the beach in Le Blanc Citron. The man said the other reporters were staying overnight and that he needed a ride out immediately. Skye watched the float plane skim across the lake for a takeoff, and she broke into laughter. Did you see Renault? He was using his injured hand to push other people out of the way so he could get on first. The mocking tone of your voice suggests that you are not sorry to see Renault leave, Austin said. She pretended she was washing her hands. Good riddance to bad rubbish, as my father used to say. Lessard, the plant manager, was standing next to Skye, and he had a sad look in his eyes as he watched the float plane leap from the lake and head toward a valley between two mountain peaks. Well, Monsieur Austin, I must go back to work, he said in a mournful voice. Thank you for the excitement you and your friends have brought to this lonely outpost. Austin grasped Lessard's hand in a firm grip. The rescue would have been impossible without your help, Austin said. I don't think you'll be alone for long. When the story gets out, you'll be inundated with reporters. The police will be sniffing around here as well. Lessard looked more pleased than annoyed. You think so? He beamed. If you'll excuse me, I'd better get back to my office to prepare for visitors. I'll have a truck drive you back to the lake if you'd like. I'll walk with you, Skye said. I've got to pick up something I left in the plant. Zavala said of Lessard, that gentleman apparently isn't content with his 15 minutes of fame. Now, if you were through with my services... Austin put his hand on Zavala's shoulder. Don't tell me you want to leave this garden spot so you can get back to Chamonix and your French pastry. Zavala's eyes followed Skye. It appears I'm not the only one partaking of the local delicacies. You're way ahead of me, Joe. The young lady and I haven't even had our first date yet. Well, I'm the last guy to stand in the way of true romance. Nor am I, Austin said, walking Zavala to the helicopter. See you in Paris.